The masters almost surely have a plan. There's clearly maybe something there beyond the realm of man. And until you've thoroughly tested every last close trusted view, I find the more you think you know, the less you really do.
That's true, Dr. Zaius.
Very well.
Where would we be without THC? Cause we know they're lying to us, just don't know.
Hello again, Higher Side Chatters, drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke, and just altering to keep from faltering in this crazy world. From sunny San Diego, I'm Greg Carlwood, and today is quite a doozy, folks, because as many of us recognized we were being lied to, it seems like 9/11 has become one of the single biggest pivot points that brought most of us to take the conspiratorial worldview a bit more seriously. Many of us saw what was happening on TV and knew that it just didn't look right, but when you filter out all the guesswork, how much do we really know about what took the Twin Towers down? Now, of course, the topic has been speculated about at length in the alternative media ever since, but as much talk as there's been, you'll find a surprisingly small number of people actually go back and look at the evidence from that day before coming up with the various explanations and theories about what happened. Well, today's guest doesn't like speculation and theories and has dedicated herself to a very impartial, tedious, and evidence-based examination of what actually happened to the World Trade Center complex on that day, which she lays out in what I now consider the quintessential textbook on 9/11. Spoiler alert, it's entitled, Where Did the Towers Go? Evidence of Directed Free Energy Weapons on 9/11. She's put more work into this than most of us have probably put into anything, and her name is Judy Wood. She's extremely qualified to examine these events, as she's earned a PhD from Virginia Tech and is a former professor of mechanical engineering. She has research expertise in experimental stress analysis, structural mechanics, materials characterization, and materials engineering science. She taught graduate and undergraduate engineering classes, and she has authored or co-authored over 60 peer-reviewed papers and journal publications in her area of expertise. I do stand in awe of her accomplishments and extreme dedication to truth-seeking, and it is really an honor to help her present this research here today. Dr. Judy Wood, welcome to THC.
Well, thank you very much for having me and for a wonderful introduction.
Absolutely. It is what I do, and you're very worthy of it. I'm so happy that you could make time for this. You've changed my mind quite a bit on those events, and honestly, I've very much suffered from 9/11 fatigue in recent years, but a listener named Jeff, that I believe you know as well, urged me to dig into your book, and I am so glad that I actually did. And to get us started, maybe you can talk to us about your approach to the subject and how it's different from everyone else. I mean, even those researchers in the so-called truth movement.
Researchers has been kind of used as a loose term for people who can type things into Google. I call that an opinion and an internet connection. That doesn't make someone an expert.
Fair.
You need years of experience in forensic engineering for diagnosing this problem. But more than that, it's observation. And our culture has been a bit corrupted into seeing how fast you can color in the dot on the multiple choice test.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than problem solving and determining what happened. So there's a list of problem solving steps for about any problem that you're going to approach. And so this doesn't just apply to 9/11, it applies to anything. 9/11 is just a perfect example to use because there's so much evidence available. But you first must determine what happened before you can determine how it happened. You have to determine what it was that happened.
Right.
Bombs did it. What was it that bombs did? You have to determine what problem you're solving before you can solve it. So you first determine what happened, and then it emerges how it happened, and then who did it and why is later. But I don't get into those things because that is not as important as what happened.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of irrelevant, almost. People like to go hang somebody, get somebody for it. Well, in this case, the technology that is revealed, you get rid of the operator of it. That doesn't get rid of the technology. There's a bunch more guys in line ready to push the button.
Good point.
That technology is there. And making sure it doesn't happen again is knowledge about this technology and being able to identify its characteristics. So you begin with what happened. And I'd like to read the definition of scientific method.
Please.
By Professor Eric Larson. He says, the scientific method, as it came into being during the Enlightenment period, is a method known as empiricism, or as the empirical method. Under the terms of empiricism, all conclusions are, must, and can be drawn from observable evidence and from observable evidence only. Evidence must precede any and every conclusion to be drawn from it. Then, if sound logic governs in the relationship between the evidence and the conclusion drawn from it, that conclusion will be irrefutable.
Well said.
And so that's why the conclusions in my book are irrefutable.
That's true. And one of the big questions that is heavily contested in the alternative realm that I feel like I now have a definitive answer to is how many buildings were destroyed that day? I think if you surveyed the audience, the most common answer would be 3, the Twin Towers and Building 7. But you have maps and diagrams that really take the guessing out. What can you tell us about that? How many buildings were really destroyed?
As I often like to emphasize, it wasn't two buildings. It wasn't just 3 buildings. It wasn't just 4 buildings or 5 or 6. But 7 buildings with a WTC prefix were destroyed that day. And I don't include the little church across the street. That was, of course, destroyed. And Bankers Trust was damaged, repaired, but then they disassembled it.
Right.
Because it still had a problem. So on that day, the buildings that were destroyed were 7 buildings, all with the WTC prefix.
And I think that's probably somewhat surprising to people. But if they get your book, I mean, it comes right on the back. You can see the outline of where all the buildings were, and it removes any speculation or doubt. But it is kind of mind-blowing when you hear that. It's more than double what most people assume. And we're talking about massive buildings. Obviously, a lot of the facts have been skewed about this event since it happened.
Or in a magic show, the magician misdirects your attention.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't lie to you. He causes you to come to the wrong conclusion. He causes you to solve the wrong problem.
Yeah.
And so if he reframes the discussion and the focus area into something over here rather than looking at the evidence, the truth always comes from the evidence. And I am a strong believer in letting the evidence tell you what happened. Don't tell the evidence what it's supposed to do. You listen to it, and it'll speak to you and tell you what happened.
Right.
If you don't know what happened, keep listening until you do. If you either you have conclusive evidence or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Malaysian Airlines 370, all the stuff on the news right after it went supposedly missing. So I won't even assume that it went missing. But everyone's saying, "Well, where'd it go? What happened? Did it get energy weapon taken out of the sky?" And I said, "Well, first of all, you have to establish what is known. Was there such a flight and did it take off? And if it took off, which direction was it going in?" I can't answer any of those questions, so I'm done.
Yeah, it's so odd. It's almost like a catch-22 sometimes because a lot of people in the alternative realm, I mean, it's kind of like conspiracy 101 to say you don't trust the media, but then, the media tells you a plane went missing, and then it becomes this big dramatic thing on television. It's just, it's really hard to discern what's real information and what isn't when a lot of it is outside of the realm of our observable effect. We have mm-hmm. to get these things through some type of source, and it becomes difficult. I know in our correspondence, you mentioned how our education system is partly to blame for all this confusion, mainly because it affects people's reasoning skills. And I totally agree with you. But between the media manipulation, the observer effect and all this, it becomes hard.
But something that even comes more surprising, then they have this alternative media. I think you're an exception to it. But this vast, internet radio business, or even best example, YouTube. People don't believe the network media, but they believe an anonymous poster on YouTube.
Right.
It boggles the mind. But as for the Malaysian Airlines thing, when folks asked me about it right after the event, I said, well, I call it the Where's Waldo scavenger hunt. what the news would have a different thing. Oh, look over here today. Look over there. And people just follow wherever the bouncing ball goes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's important to establish what you know. Now, there's a question I've been waiting for you to ask, and you did. And I said today was a wonderful day for this interview because it was the birthday of my hero, my childhood and continuing on adult hero.
Right. Who is that hero?
It's the 543rd birthday. Nicholas Copernicus.
Ah.
And in fifth grade, beautiful assignment. We had good schools then. There was 28 kids in our class, and we were given the assignment of, each day on the calendar in the month of February. Each one of us were responsible for finding somebody who was born that day, what significance. Well, I ended up picking Copernicus. And ever since then, I've always celebrated his birthday on February 19th.
Wow, synchronistic that we're doing this. I did do some Googling trying to figure out who it was, but I couldn't figure it out.
What impressed me the most at that age was he took a licking and kept on ticking, as I'd put it. He was confronted in so many different directions. You remember my favorite phrase, know what it is that you know that you know that you know, and know that everything else you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
The most famous phrase by Copernicus is, I'll read it, to know that we know what we know, and to know that what we do not know, we do not know. That is true knowledge.
Boom, there it is. And so true. It's important to keep the facts on the table and remove the speculation.
Right.
My friend Gordon White, he's a really good researcher. He always talks about separating data from interpretation. Sometimes a guest or a researcher will have mined some important bits of data, but they pack it in with a lot of their own biases and speculation, and we have to know how to sift through that to just pull out that data. You know, it's a similar kind of thing.
But when people mix in the speculation, that's another thing I do. If any part of your data set is corrupt, you have to throw all of it out.
Damn.
Otherwise, you're biasing your sampling of the data. So if somebody you're listening to, they tell the truth most of the time, but they have some other things that are just outright bogus. I don't listen to them anymore. They're done.
It's over.
And that's, in my profession, that's how it was. In experimental mechanics, you're presenting data, and if you are found to have fudged your data or you misrepresent somebody else's data, you're done for the rest of your life.
Mm, well said.
You've lost your credibility. So being able to stay within the bounds of what you know that you know that you know is important. You can state on the side, we can speculate about X, Y, and Z, but do not mix that in as a statement of fact. And I think that's one of the errors that also happens. Another example of, in case the audience isn't familiar with who Nicholas Copernicus was, heliocentric solar system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the sun's in the middle, not the Earth.
Right.
He caught a lot of flack for that. But, some other statements he made, he had to be sure of what he knew that he knew. And he went through that a lot. Even though other people were firing at him, he knew what he knew that he knew. And I sort of experienced that on 9/11. I was in the faculty conference room, and the building looks like it's turning to dust. And everyone said, oh, look at the collapse. As soon as the media said collapse, again, I shut off my ears.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not worth listening to, but I'm looking at the image. You know, I look at, like, this is ridiculous. That's not a collapse. And they looked at me like I was a lunatic.
Mm-hmm.
It was the creepiest day of my life. So how do I sort out, objectively, is it me who's crazy or is it the rest of the world? And it's probably the same thing that Copernicus went through. So I went up to my office and started doing calculations. And you remember the billiard ball chapter, ball example. It's just a mental example. That actually came from that day. When I devised, simple equations about billiard balls and then went to my colleagues, they act like I was having a senior moment because it's so simple. Well, of course that's right. They checked my mind. Of course that's right. But if it was applied to the Twin Towers, I was a lunatic. So that's how I differentiated. And so, knowing what you know that you know and being sure of it instead of being swayed by doubt from others and being sure. So what did we see that day?
Right.
The building's turning to dust. There's another engineer who bought my book, read it, and was so impressed they made a movie about it. I was meaning to send you the link.
Ah.
It's it was recently released. If you go to tinyurl.com/irrefutable TV, all one word.
Hmm.
And there's several different chapters, one on dustification. And if people want to observe the video, it shows this clear video. They point out a different aspect, but I usually point out this steel beam falling down in front of the corner of the North Tower.
Yes.
And then pretty soon you notice there's no more rigid material anymore. It's just dust.
Mm-hmm. And that's a big part of the book. You use the term dustification, and we should talk about that a little bit, or maybe have you define it, because that is what happened to the Twin Towers. It really replaces the word collapse.
Exactly. I get a lot of grief for using unusual words, but actually this is more scientific than anything else. Hmm. If you, this is a key thing. If you assign a known name for a known phenomena to unknown phenomena, you're biasing your observations. For example, you see this hazy atmosphere above the ground, and you say it's smoke. Well, then you're automatically assuming fire is the cause.
Mm-hmm.
And so I use the word fumes. They could be chemical fumes. They could be fumes from a fire. They could, you know, it doesn't specify what it is. And then there's these orange glowing things that look like they're probably pipes that were glowing orange. I call them Cheetos. I don't know what it is. It's not something glowing red hot because I don't have a thermocouple on it to determine what temperature it is.
Right.
And in my book, I give the example of a fluorescent light and an incandescent light. You know, one glows because it's hot and one isn't hot.
Hmm.
You could change the light bulb on the fluorescent one without burning your hands, but you wouldn't do that on an incandescent bulb.
Yeah.
It's a different process that's producing the brightness. So just because it's glowing does not mean that it's hot.
Good point. And I do like those different terms you use. I think it makes it easier to understand some of this complex stuff.
And it really is the most scientific, because we don't know. You don't say that hot glowing, you know, pipe over there. If I call it a Cheeto, you're not going to confuse that with a piece of food, but it's an easy term to remember. And so you can identify this glowing orange piece of stuff.
Yeah, makes sense to me. And I did hope early on we could kind of dispel some of the misconceptions so that we can reach people who think they might already have the answer. And of course, I think 95% of listeners here will acknowledge the official story makes no sense. Planes alone did not destroy these towers. But I think some of them might have bought into some of the theories that I also bought into originally. Probably the most widespread is that this was just a perfectly executed controlled demolition. Why is that not a sufficient answer? How does the evidence contradict that?
Okay. With a controlled demolition with bombs in the building, you know, you have materials blown apart, big kaboom, and junk goes flying and then, you know, lands on the ground. Big solid chunks land on the ground. So you get a seismic signal showing that the bombs went boom, and then you'd also get the junk falling to the ground. And both of those are like a hammer hitting a tuning fork. You know, the ground would ring.
Right.
Let's look at the seismic charts. Well, the seismic charts from quite a few different seismic stations around the area do not show anything hitting the ground.
Hmm.
They just have a surface wave. And the surface wave isn't all that big. They calculate the equivalent Richter scale reading from the surface wave. And the Richter scale equivalent reading was less than or equivalent to a building that was blown up with controlled demolition that was 1/30th, that's, you know, 3 times 10, 1/30th of the potential energy. You know, it's mass times height.
Hmm.
But if you dustified all but the bottom 16 or 20 stories of each of the towers, you would indeed get the equivalent surface wave.
Mm-hmm. I found that to be some of the most compelling evidence. Of course, the charts and the data and reading it is a little over my head. I have to kind of trust your expertise, but...
But you can identify the charts.
Right.
See, like, where's the signal? Like for Building 7, you know, actually they calculated when they expected the S and P wave to arrive because it was nothing detectable.
Right.
From all 5 of the stations. They couldn't even detect a surface wave in one of the stations. Now, for the listeners, S and P wave, the P wave is the primary wave that is first to arrive. It travels through the Earth, and it travels faster than the shear wave or secondary wave. And as you probably remember from earthquakes, the lag time between those two can tell you how far away from the recording station the epicenter is.
Mm-hmm.
For all 5 events in New York that day, there was no S or P wave recorded, only surface waves.
Right. That's so interesting. I mean, you have to take that into account when you're trying to figure out what happened to these towers, because any other answer would result in all that material just crashing to the ground. And of course it would create a huge wave. And you actually have some quotes in the book from people who actually say they didn't even remember hearing an impact.
Right. But if also, if you mash the building to the ground, forget about, well, let's first deal with the bombs. If you have bombs in the building, they shoot things at high speed. They go boom for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's above the speed of sound, an explosion, a sudden expansion. So they're going to launch junk out there, you know, chunks out. And so the adjacent buildings would all look machine gun fired by these chunks getting launched. And that didn't happen. But even without that, if you're going to say it's a pancake collapse, it happened naturally, that you cut columns internally that nobody saw, and the building came, you know, getting smooshed to the ground, you have all this material that was not there at the end of the, quote, collapse. If you had this pile driver riding the pile down, where's the pile driver?
Mm-hmm.
But if it mashed everything down, let's save argument's sake, you have every single window open or removed in the whole building. If it's going to go away in the time it takes for the roof to free fall to the ground, by the time it gets to the ground, the material inside in the air is having to be thrown out at, you know, like Mach 2.
Mm-hmm.
You know what happens when an airplane does a jet engine run up on the tarmac instead of the concrete? Mm-hmm. There's some pictures in my book. Is for a guy driving a 767 Boeing, did the engine run up on the tarmac, and it tore up the tarmac, just the air coming out of the engines, tore up the tarmac and threw chunks through the tail of the plane. So if you had all that much air rushing out, you would have all sorts of chunks thrown all over the place. And again, you'd have it looked like machine gun fire on all the adjacent buildings.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't happen.
Yeah. And there was one quote here I did have from an EMT, Ronald Cohn. But he said that as the building was coming down, he kicked in the window of an SUV and went to climb in for protection. And he said that in the time it took him to kick out the window, his safety jacket was already on fire, his socks were on fire. And that's a little weird. I mean, that's not consistent with the demolition of any kind. It's like this field was lighting his clothes on fire, not something from inside the building.
Mm-hmm. Right. And he didn't get burned up. There's somebody else whose shoelaces got on fire and their jacket was on fire. But that's their description,
mm-hmm.
You know, lit up. But they didn't describe getting any burns from it.
Yeah. And you also have a report from the chief medical officer, David Prezant. I guess he said that the lack of noise was odd. Again, a high ranking person who is an emergency responder and should have a good idea of, you know, what happened on the scene. And he says it also. I mean, he doesn't speculate much further, but he definitely acknowledges that the two largest buildings in New York crashing to the ground should have made a little more noise.
Right. It's, and some of them didn't even know that building two went away. Building one got an airplane shaped hole in it. We won't assume how it got it, but it had a hole, got a hole. And then the South Tower got a hole. And then the South Tower went poof. That's my simple term for, you know, went away. And then the North Tower went away. That's the sequence of things. And there was a fellow who contacted me who worked in Tower 1 when it got its hole. He knew he wasn't going to get any work done that day, so he grabbed his stuff and decided he was going to head home. And he walked past Tower 2. He saw that it looked like it was fuming, but it looked like things were under control. And he went down to the ferry terminal. He commutes by ferry. And while he was standing there, some guy, they thought it was an idiot, because he came up and said, Tower 2 just collapsed. Well, wait a minute. It's got to be an idiot, because he just walked past the building and it was, you know, standing. It was in fairly good health, you know, the bottom part of it. And they didn't feel a building hit the ground. They didn't hear a building hit the ground.
Mm-hmm.
They got on the ferry, pulled out into the Hudson, looked back, and there's only one tower standing.
Hmm.
He was just shocked. It was just unreal. And then there's this big, huge dust cloud, and he realized that was the remains of Tower 2.
Yeah.
It really, really shocked him.
That is another element that I just think really spits in the face of those alternative ideas that are shuffled around the conspiracy world. Another one of the big camps is that nanothermite was used to sort of melt the beams of the building, even hearing reports that they found the components of thermite at the site. Why is this not a reasonable explanation for what brought them down either?
Whether it's, thermite is like a 19th century technology. Hmm. It's used for welding railroad tracks. Nanothermite just means it works faster.
Mm-hmm.
And it works through heat transfer. So if you put it on the surface, it takes a while for the heat to get in there. But if it burns faster, it's all burnt up before the heat transfer, can happen. So it kind of does the wrong thing. But there's a piece of evidence that was missing on that day. And let's see if I can play the clip for you.
Sure.
Remember that Manfred Mann, Earth Band song? I guess it originally was written by Bruce Springsteen, or this is the beginning version here.
Blinded by the light.
If that building was taken apart with, thermite, nanothermite, or whatever, it would be lit up like a giant sparkler.
Mm.
Have you seen somebody, weld something?
Right, yeah.
It spits sparks all over the place.
Very bright.
Nobody recalls having seen that, and nobody was blinded.
So that pretty much solves that problem.
Yeah. So we have the survivors in Stairway B,
yes,
which I believe is the bottom of the spire. I don't have proof of that, but it sure looks like that was a stairwell.
Mm-hmm.
That what is referred to as the spire. It's some core columns that are left standing about 700 feet tall.
Right.
You can estimate that because it towers way over Building 7. And anyway, these guys were down at the base of that building in Stairway B on the second, third, and fourth floor. Thought they were goners, because they thought they're buried under 102 stories of stuff. But when the dust cleared, or 106 stories, when the dust cleared, they looked up and saw blue sky.
Yeah, I thought that was so compelling. I mean, clearly people inside the building should be crushed by it falling on them, but to look up and see blue skies and not die.
And where's the building? One described walking out onto what looked like an empty football field.
Gosh.
The debris field. And also, if you were taking apart the building, restoring it with thermite, these guys would have been cooked to death.
Mm.
And none of them remembered being cooked to death. I say that, kind of silly tone, sarcastically, but they weren't burned. None of them described having been burned.
Mm-hmm.
And there was 14 people. There was also two people above that around the 22nd floor who survived, even though the building around them did not survive. There's one of them that landed on the top of the cluster of stairs. He wasn't with the other ones, but he ended up landing on top of Stairway B in the top surface when he rode the wave down. And he ended up coming home that night. His wife was watching the event on TV and thought she watched her husband be destroyed in that building. Then he comes home that night.
Hmm.
Quite amazing.
Yeah, it really is. It's so odd how the evidence, when you look at it, and when you look through this book and all the work you've done, the evidence is so far different than what so many people have in their heads about what happened.
Mm-hmm. So these survivors in Stairway B, on top of Stairway B, are evidence that the building did not burn up, it didn't get crushed to the ground, but it turned to dust in midair.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is consistent with that.
Yeah, and it's hard to fathom, but the evidence is what the evidence is. And I've heard you say that it was a psychological operation. A lot of people admit that, but you said, do you think they also just forgot to plan a cover-up too? And I think that's a great point. How much of what the alternative media is looking at comes from this manipulation? Do you think there's a lot of orchestrated alternatives put out there?
Well, from the get-go, those who were in charge of this event, were they not anticipating somebody be asking questions?
Mm-hmm.
Of course not. There would be people asking questions. People like to join groups and be with like-minded people. So you build it and they will come.
Mm-hmm.
I call those collection agencies. People get into those collection agencies and it's groupthink. And they're given an answer and they have other people that confirm it around them. So then they join in without thinking themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look back, these groups have been around since when, and who's done anything?
Right. They just kind of talk and talk.
Oh, we need a new investigation. Well, there has been one. but they cover it up.
Right.
They've been trained to cover it up. And so they clearly they're not interested in investigation. Well, we need legal action. There was legal action. Anyone who supported it in those groups was banned from the groups. Oh, so, you know, they were taught that's bad. You don't want to support that evidence. Mm. But few people realize that there was a legal case. And if enough people supported it, it could have had some teeth.
Yes.
But in this case, there was only like a handful of people. I count every one of them. You know, there's only, let's see, three people other than my lawyer and myself who were at that hearing. This was the Court of Appeals. And in their written decision, they acknowledge the law applied to this case, but they're ignoring the law to dismiss the case.
Yeah, I did want to talk about that. And we might as well talk about it now, just the whole legal battle, because not only have you done the tedious research for this whole investigation in this textbook I got here, but you actually did pursue the legal case. And I know your focus is specifically on what happened to the towers, but everybody does want to know who's responsible. And I know that your work has kind of brought you closer to answering that question than
anyone.
Than anyone.
Yeah, see, you don't speculate, but I know who can tell you. The NIST report, National Institute of Standards and Technology, they were mandated by Congress to determine why and how the towers collapsed. They didn't do that. Instead, they built a computer model and did a hypothetical scenario. They didn't analyze the collapse. They just, this is, you know, hypothetical thing. Then they listed an inventory of the steel that went into the building and, you know, this type of steel, that type of steel, and lots of data.
Right.
But they ignored the data and just, you know, had this hypothetical model. Well, the outfit that did the hypothetical modeling, they're the outfit that had the most number of contractors hired onto the, of any of the contractors, the most number of employees on the NIST report. This is an organization that is part of the military-industrial complex, mm-hmm. but their areas of expertise, PSYOP, as well as development and manufacturing of energy weapons.
Hmm.
They also held and still, I believe, hold a contract with the U.S. government to know everything about any weapon of mass destruction that exists or is being developed anywhere.
Wow.
So they not only can identify what technology, but whose technology, who owns that particular, you know, gizmo.
Right. And so they are definitely complicit, at least in a cover.
Well, if they're, you know, out to lunch and just, you know, compartmentalization, you can excuse it too. But wouldn't it have been nice to have them under oath and ask them some questions?
Right.
Those are the ones that I was the most interested in asking questions. That's Applied Research Associates.
And is that who you sued for fraud?
Well, all of them. But, you know, it's more difficult to sue a government agency, but contractors, no, that's whistleblowing.
Yeah.
You know, these contractors generated a fake scenario. And then also Science Application International Corporation, SAIC, it typed up the report. Uh-huh. And you know what their expertise is? PSYOP.
Wow.
They also supervised the site during the cleanup from like immediately afterwards and onward. So they obviously knew of all this dirt that was coming and going.
Mm.
And it'd be nice to have asked them questions about that. You know, where did this idea come from that you needed to bring in fresh dirt, dump it down, stir it around, you know, scoop it back up, take it out, bring in new dirt?
Yeah, it is really surprising that, well, you know, it's not surprising to someone cynical minded or conspiracy minded that they wouldn't hear the case. But the judge actually made some statement that was pretty bizarre about not wanting to hear a case about who shot JFK or who landed on the moon.
Oh, that was the lower court judge.
Ah.
And that's why we appealed it, because they, you know, that excuse me, sir, this case isn't about that.
Right. Has nothing to do with who landed on the moon or shot JFK.
Right. He was just trying to make it go away. And he also threatened that if I appealed it, you know, I was going to get sanctioned or something like that. But anyway, having been,
blackballed?
Well, no, or having also the Court of Appeals deny the case, went to the Supreme Court so we could say we did it all. And they only have to hear cases now if they feel like hearing them. If they don't feel like hearing them, they don't have to say why they don't feel like hearing them.
Right. Gatekeepers.
Yeah, so of course they didn't feel like hearing this case. So it didn't bother them that the Court of Appeals said, we're ignoring the law to dismiss the case.
Hmm.
But you can bet if you had a few thousand people out in the streets holding signs saying, why is this court ignoring the law to dismiss the case?
Right. Unfortunately, there's no attention on it.
Right. So if you're an operator of the cover-up group, isn't that what you'd make sure that there was nobody would be wanting to support that case?
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
And why wouldn't they want to support this case? Because they have one of their own? Well, they don't have a court case of their own.
Right.
Now, the biggest thing I have pride in is I was not sanctioned by the courts. I took it all the way to the top. Wasn't sanctioned. In other words, it was not seen as a frivolous case. And to the Supreme Court, cleared up my statement, said, didn't burn up, nor did it slam the ground, but turned to dust in midair. That's in there. It has to be a much more concise. You're limited to 25 pages, and that includes all of the addresses of all the, you know, legal stuff on both sides and, mm-hmm. you know, all the stuff. But that was a statement that was in there.
Hmm.
And also that NIST acknowledged to me they did not analyze the collapse. That was the first person to bring that to their attention. They didn't, you know, they can't call it a collapse if they didn't analyze it.
True.
And I said, well, this tipping top of Tower 2 violates the laws of physics if that falls as a rigid body, if that's a rigid body and it didn't turn to dust in midair. Because if they were claiming, you know, an airplane hit it and damaged it at, you know, 35 stories below the top, then why is the top disintegrating?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's another thing about that demonstrates it turned to dust, that if you have a rigid body rotating, it's going to keep rotating if it remains a rigid body due to the laws of conservation of angular momentum. But if it's not a rigid body, if each of the little particles in there starts rotating separately, it can maintain the laws of conservation of angular momentum and appear, you know, from a distance to stop rotating because it's all turned to dust and each of the dust particles are rotating. Do you follow?
I do.
Oh, cool. Cool. So that's another, that's more evidence that it, but anyway, I brought this to the attention of NIST and they said, oh, it doesn't violate the laws of physics. Because I said their analysis violated the laws of physics. And they said, because we didn't analyze the collapse. The building obeyed the laws of physics while it was standing. And that's as much as we analyzed. It was, you know, it obeyed the laws of physics while it was standing. So, because the rest was a hypothetical scenario they brought about. They didn't, it didn't relate to the collapse or the actual demise.
Yeah. So another thing about dustification is the bathtub. It's another one of those terms that you use.
Yeah.
And I found it to be pretty compelling. It tells us a little bit about the construction of the World Trade Center complex that I think a lot of people might not be aware of, but it actually sits down into what you call the bathtub. And that's something that you would think would have been damaged. But tell us a little bit about that piece of evidence.
Okay, the towers were built in the Hudson River. You know, southern Manhattan real estate is pretty valuable. So they want to make more of it. So they dammed up, you know, with kind of a dike, an area out in the Hudson, then built this concrete wall, kind of a dike around the edge. Some call it the slurry wall. And built the towers on bedrock that was 70 feet, that's 7 times 10, 70 feet below sea level. Or, you know, the water table, and you have this, you know, dike keeping out the Hudson River. With Tower 1 sitting just, you know, the edge of it, you know, just a few feet away from it. So if these buildings go slamming down to the ground, you're going to bust up that dike.
Right. Water should have flooded lower Manhattan.
Right. And some people have been saying, you know, because of a debunker video, they claim that, well, that's ridiculous because there's even more stuff further out now. The World Financial Center is built further out. Well, think of it as a boat, that the towers are built in a boat. And just because you pull another boat up next to it doesn't mean that it's now above sea level.
Right.
So they're both, you know, in jeopardy. That one's got its own bathtub walls around it, but the ends don't. And it's still fragile. And actually, right after the demise of the towers, because there wasn't anything in there much anymore. It was gone, you know, the underground structure in a lot of places. So the bathtub was unsupported inside where stuff had been. It was empty. So when they brought in the earth moving equipment to start cleaning up stuff, they quickly realized it was damaging the bathtub wall. On Liberty Street, the wall started leaning inwards. There's a big crack in Liberty Street. And then they realized, whoops, we've got to establish new rules. These big mega cranes, I call them, have to be on wooden platforms that distribute the load and have to be X number of feet from the build, from the bathtub wall, and can't have another one close to it within X number of feet because it was damaging the bathtub wall. And it's how it weighs how much? A mega crane compared to the weight of the building? These are 2 500,000-ton buildings that supposedly came crashing down, but a piece of earth-moving equipment did more damage.
Mm.
Now, you know, why would it you flooded Manhattan? Well, the PATH train that goes under the Hudson over to New Jersey connects into the bathtub, as well as the subways that go all over Manhattan. So if the bathtub springs a leak, everything's getting flooded. And actually, they had water in there, so they were afraid that there was a leak. And so they made this big plug in late October, I think, that plugged up the PATH train tunnel going over New Jersey so that you wouldn't have, I guess, Exchange Place Station over there. That wouldn't be flooded out if there's a big leak or, you know, whatnot. But it turns out you had fire hoses in there and you had rain without the water having anywhere to go, you know, because they've opened up the bathtub. So it was collecting all this stuff. And once they pumped it out, it stayed dry.
Mm.
And the same with the tunnel. Once they pumped that out, it stayed dry. Imagine that. It was built in the early 1900s. These tunnels that go under the Hudson and come up on bedrock in the bathtub. You would think if you know, something had gone ka-thud on the bedrock, it would shake the concrete in those tunnels and crack them.
Right.
Didn't happen. I guess they used to build stuff better.
Yeah, I definitely found that to be one of the compelling pieces of evidence. Because again, I keep coming back to this thing of if they collapsed, apparently, then there should be either damage to the bathtub, some type of seismic data we can get.
And a big pile of stuff left over.
Right. I mean, it really was dustified. And another thing people talk about a lot is those witnesses who say they heard bombs in the basement. Now, there were apparently explosions, but what were the source of those explosions?
Oh, whoops, I just heard an explosion out in my kitchen. Oh, I'm sorry, I was cooking an egg in my microwave. Yeah, just because you hear a boom doesn't mean it's a bomb. And there were a few things that were actually identified as having exploded. But think about it. You have this big, tall building, and if you're a civil engineer, you know that you can only pump water up so far before you need to establish a new head. You can't pump water from the ground up to the top floor. The pressure is going to be unbelievable. So they pump it up, you know, 10 stories or so into a holding tank, and then they pump it from that tank up. So they have tanks throughout the building. You're not going to use a corner office for a water tank. You'd probably use the mid-face of a building, of the building. Because the inside, the center part is where you have elevators and stuff, so you can't put water tanks in the elevators.
Mm-hmm.
So the mid-face, every so often, you're going to have a water tank. Now, if you're dustifying a water tank, what's going to happen? At some point, it's going to cut loose. You know, a pressure vessel, if you start weakening the wall, at some point, it's going to not hold the pressure anymore. Think of a balloon. If you set a balloon on some acid that would gradually be eating through the rubber balloon, it would come to a point where it would weaken the wall to the point that the balloon exploded.
Mm-hmm.
So you have all these pressure vessels in the building. You have air tanks, you know, for the, I call them turbo toilets, you know, to make the water more effective, like on the top floor.
Sure.
And so forth, and as well as having the water all the way up. So you have a lot of pressure vessels in that building. And you're going to expect them to go boom.
Do you think that's what people were seeing? Like when you watch some of these documentaries and they're trying to highlight little explosions that are, you know.
The squirts, I call them the squirts out of the mid-face every so often. I don't have proof of it, but to me it sure looks like the way water would cut loose and spray out.
Could make sense.
It doesn't look like a bomb. A bomb would have a, you know, a cloud of like smoke around it.
Mm-hmm.
This looks like more of a water spraying, but it's right where you would expect water tanks to be every so often in the mid-face of the building. Yeah. And exactly in that center. If you're going to blow up the building with bombs, don't you want to put them in the corners? Yeah. Why in the mid-face?
Mm-hmm.
I guess there's a lot more to that. But the few things that were actually identified as what was exploding, are you familiar with that? It's in chapter 7.
Well, I did see the thing about on the ground, some of the emergency vehicles.
Right, right. And let's see. So here it is, page 110 and 111. I don't know if you want to read one of those for example.
Whichever one you think would be most appropriate.
Well, Todd Heaney, firefighter, 110.
He says, I remember getting a drink of water out of the cooler there, and then we just started to put out the car fires, and the rigs were going, ambulances. I mean, there must have been 50 of these things burning heavily. The Scott cylinders and the oxygen cylinders were all letting go. They were all blowing up left and right.
And the Scott cylinders, and there's a picture of one there, those are the air tanks the firefighters wear so they can breathe clean air in a smoky environment.
So those are blowing up.
Yeah, they have those on their fire trucks at ground level, and they're exploding.
So we're looking at a lot of interesting evidence that doesn't fit the explanations we've been given thus far, and we're talking about dustification. Tell us a little bit about, as we're getting to kind of the midpoint here, what is being suggested? What can we look at that has what you call parallel evidence to suggest that that might be what's happening?
One of the biggest pieces of evidence, and you know, think of water when it becomes steam. The atoms need, or the molecules need 1,600 times the volume. That's 1,600 times more space. They need more elbow room. So that's why you get steam explosions. Because when water immediately turns to steam, it needs to expand. Mm-hmm. Think of that concept. Now apply it kind of as an analogy to what you think is solid building material. Suddenly all these atoms need to, you know, get away from each other. If the atoms are no longer attracted to each other, but instead want to repel each other, what would that look like? And then when you look at the building frothing out into dust, kind of looks like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or the steel beams that look like they're put in a jar of water, like as though they're an Alka-Seltzer tablet. Now, Alka-Seltzer is a rigid material. Until you change its environment, you put it in a glass of water and it fizzes and dissolves.
Yeah.
Steel is a rigid material until you change its environment and it fizzes and dissolves.
And that might be what this energy field or weapon is like, I suppose.
Well, it's, again, don't speculate. And a lot of people, I could go on for the rest of this hour and the next saying, I don't talk about this. I don't talk about that. No, that's not what I say. No, that's not what I say. Then we wouldn't have time left to talk about what I do say.
Right.
You know, it's what the evidence leads to the conclusion of that's, irrefutable as well, that the atoms and molecules are now repelling each other where they normally attract each other. Something instructed them to do that. Something directed them to do that. I call that directed energy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about space beams, laser beams from outer space. Huh. Actually, right here, I'll make it clear. I can rule out laser beams from wherever, because I'm talking about the destructive mechanism. What happened actually to the material? What was the mechanism of destruction? What caused the material to come apart? Something didn't hit it, like a hammer. Gravity collapse would be that type of thing. That's kinetic energy. So we can rule out kinetic energy because it would also show up in the seismic thing. Mm-hmm. That's why you have to rule out pulverization, because we see these beams flying through the air and they're not hitting anything.
Right.
It's not kinetic energy that's destroying those. And thermal energy, we explained the building didn't get cooked to death. So it didn't get beaten to death nor cooked to death. So we can rule out thermal energy as well. And what I'm calling the destructive mechanism is directed energy or instructed energy.
Mm-hmm.
The energy was directed to do something differently than it normally does. So laser beams, what destructive mechanism would they cause? Thermal. They would heat something up.
Right.
And so that's not the destructive mechanism here. So those can be ruled out. But it's important just to, talk about what we know that we know that we know. So the material, something caused it to want to come apart. And then, okay, what else do we know? Let's go look at some parallel evidence. I think that's what you were suggesting.
Right.
So what other things similar to this? Well, putting it on the level that I think anyone just about can relate to, tornadoes.
Okay.
You know, my detractors often say, well, you need to calculate how much energy would required to turn the building to dust. So, you know, if you can't do that, you've got nothing. No, it doesn't, you know, calculations are an assumption. Because what are you calculating? We're talking about visible evidence, mm-hmm. you know, empirical evidence. And what is the empirical evidence of tornadoes? You don't have to calculate where the energy came from that caused their destruction. You just know that this weather system causes destruction.
Right.
That's all you need to know. And horrendous destruction. And it's very weird. We're often taught that it's wind, but you can identify that it is not wind. You can have a stack of papers sitting on the bookshelf in a particular room. I witnessed this in Texas about 3 years ago, I think it was, and the roof's gone. Big screen TV, flat screen TV is there, not damaged. Roof's gone, and the papers aren't blown around the room. They're just sitting there.
Hmm.
It's pretty miraculous. Now, Building 4 looked like the main body was sliced off and gone, removed, except for the little corner of it, and it's only the north wing left of Building 4. And when I saw that, it reminded me of a tornado in Topeka, Kansas. I saw when I was a kid. We're going to be driving to my grandmother's house. And the night before we were to leave, there's this horrendous tornado. It was the biggest in U.S. history that we'd known of. And we drove through Topeka, and we went past, I thought it was an apartment building, but I think it was a dorm. But for a kid, it was an apartment building. It was sliced in two. Half of it was just gone. The other half, there's a bed in there. It was perfectly made, had some magazines on the bedspread and some books on the dresser and clothes hanging in the closet, nothing disturbed.
Mm-hmm.
How could that be if it's wind? Wind isn't black and white. It's shades of gray in between. You have a strong wind, and next to that strong wind, you have a less strong wind and it tapers off. You don't have a 2,000-mile-per-hour wind next to it 0 miles per hour.
Right.
So that doesn't explain this.
And, of course, no one saw a tornado near the Twin Towers either.
Right. Well, let's think about it. What happens if you weaponize a tornado? Do you think they haven't somebody somewhere hasn't studied how to start and stop tornadoes? So for all we know, this you could call this a weaponized tornado.
Hmm. Wouldn't we see some type of funnel?
It depends on how they create it.
Okay.
We saw what people are calling smoke. We saw these fumes coming out of the tower for a while. And also, we don't know what the various components are. And in other parallel evidence, you know, there's a type of field interference that, like John Hutchison's work, he creates a static field. And within the static field, he interferes various radio frequency signals like microwaves.
Mm-hmm.
So you need a static field and and where that interference is where these weird things happen.
Right.
So you have a general static field, but then specifically, you know, you want to affect that item or that item. There's a lot of parallels with what he does. And, of course, I went there and it is a lab slash apartment and witnessed what he has. You know, there's a lot of detractors like to say, oh, he made it up. They have all sorts of speculation, but how many of them have actually gone observed?
Right. In the past, I had heard about John Hutchison and the Hutchison effect, and I had heard it kind of equated to, oh, this gets into the realm of electrogravitic levitation type technologies. And it does seem there's like some type of physics that just seems to be quarantined from modern science, and it might have many different effects. But I guess this John Hutchison guy is someone who's been messing with direct energy, and he records his experiments and
directed, as in like instructed
directed energy. And it has some strange effects. He has taken a metal beam, and it looks like it collapses in on itself, kind of.
Oh, not just that, but there's even some samples that some he sent to, or another scientist in Canada sent to a metallurgy department at a major university. I can tell you which one, but that's not important. And asked them how to reproduce that. They couldn't. They had no idea how it was made and couldn't reproduce it.
Hmm.
It's quite interesting, you know, from the white world of science, meaning above the table. It's not known, but in the black world, you know, below the table, obviously it's known. And Hutchison is never signed on any confidentiality agreements, any top secret agreements not to disclose anything. Like if you go work for a government agency, you get a security clearance and you can't talk about it.
Right.
So the beauty of his work is that he's not restrained that way. And the same with me. And there's not a lot of people that are in that position.
Right. That is definitely key to what you're doing. Does John talk much about this? Does he think that this could be scaled up to destroy buildings of that size?
Yeah, but he's not into weaponry. He's into, let's see what good we can use it for. And I think that is the focus. Mm-hmm. And as for the title of my book, of course, we get, you know, detractors spinning what the meaning is. I say it's evidence of free energy technology in 9/11. What is in the book is evidence that a technology exists that can do what was done.
Mm-hmm.
But that evidence is also of a technology exists that doesn't have to be used for destruction. It can be used for good purposes. It can be used to provide free energy to the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's the meaning of that statement. It's evidence of directed free energy technology.
Right. And that makes sense. It's also what apparently people talk about Nikola Tesla talking about this kind of thing, that the things that he was working on could be used for providing energy.
Providing free energy. Right. And he was worried that it was going to be used for evil purposes.
Right. And so here we are.
Well, we don't have that worry anymore. That risk has already been realized. But the important thing, if you want this to not be used for evil purposes, look at what it does. If everybody can identify when it gets used, the user can't get away with it.
Right.
And it's less likely to use it. And also the other end of it is, you know, you don't have to go to John Hutchison's lab to verify that such a phenomenon is true, that it exists. Everyone is familiar with 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the buildings. They're turning to dust. You're told to see something else, but look at them. They're turning to dust in midair. That means everyone in the world with eyes is capable of knowing that free energy technology exists.
Yeah, and it's a sticky situation because, of course, a big part of what we do is looking at things like alternative energy and the idea of a free energy or cold fusion generator or zero point energy. These are the terms people talk about. But isn't it a little dangerous if, you know, let's say we could outfit every home with a type of zero point energy generator. If that thing could be switched on to be a weapon, I mean, obviously we can't do that.
It already is. It already is.
Right, but we can't give one to everyone.
No, it already is. This is something that I don't talk about that much that needs to be shown. You know how Hutchison's work is you create a static field within that interfere radio frequency signal. Well, in the Midwest of the United States, you know, it's normal every year to have tornadoes, lots of them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's a band of tornadoes that goes up Tornado Alley. Now, you remember in the summer of 2008, we suddenly had a huge increase in immediate, like, became mega tornadoes.
Mm-hmm.
And each year since then, you know, the thing in Joplin, Missouri.
Right. Near my hometown.
Yeah. A whole lot of these kinds of things. Did you think that was kind of interesting how they went up as a step function? And of course, we have the backdrop of, oh, it's climate change that's doing it. But let's look at what causes tornadoes, what they are about. You get I've lived a lot of my growing years in Kansas City, and you can smell a tornado in the air. You probably know what I mean.
I've never been that close, but I've heard that.
You can feel it. You know, the pink kind of color sky, you can sense it because right. You feel that static environment. That being the case, a storm system has a static field around it. Now, what happened in the summer of 2008? Well, if you remember, February 2009 was the deadline for switching over to digital television. So you had a whole lot of new radio frequency transmission towers going in.
Right.
All over the place.
Hmm.
Now, what can they do? Well, you have a normal static field, and then you have nice radio frequency signals. Remember the birds that fell out of the sky in Beebe, Arkansas?
Yeah, the mass die-offs?
They fell out of the sky, dead.
Hmm.
I looked there, and yeah, a storm system had just moved through, and you had radio towers going across that path. Now think of all of the new wireless transmissions, wireless internet, wireless this, wireless that, cell phone towers. What are we doing to our atmosphere? Who has studied that? They don't want you to have solar energy because it might hurt the environment, but let's not think about all this wireless stuff. So go back to what we do know. John Hutchison's work, he creates a static field and it interferes with radio frequency signals. So what do we expect in our environment?
Yeah, same similar type of thing.
So you have any wonder why this that, you know, it could be very much be an unintended consequence if somebody's just blindly putting up cell phone towers and doesn't think anything of it, that you have now these mega tornadoes and a whole lot more destruction with them.
Right. Man, that's really disturbing when you think about, yeah, all those signals out there.
Yeah, who studied the effects of all these things? And charging up the environment. And if the environment is charged up, if you know anything about air filtration systems, you put a static field around the air going into an air filter, and it causes the contaminants to stick together more in clumps, and they get caught in the mechanical filter better. They can precipitate out. Now, let's talk about chemtrails. Think about that. You have airplanes moving through the environment, but maybe the environment's changed. It's got a static charge to it. So when a plane flies through it, it precipitates out contaminants in the air. You know, like you have moisture in the air, and that makes a condensation trail.
Right.
But if you have a static charge in the air, I'm willing to bet the same thing kind of happens. And that, you know, I'm not saying I have proof of that, but that's, I think, a good direction to look in, that that's what, you know, the chemtrails might be about.
Wow. Well, Dr. Wood, I very much appreciate you being here. I think you really are the top of the 9/11 researchers out there, and you've done a lot to change my mind, and just by showing all the evidence as you do. But before we call
I'm a forensic engineer, not, you know, a truther.
Right.
So it's a difference there, but
it does make a difference for sure.
Yeah. But one thing I mentioned is somebody who bought my book. After they read it, they said, wait a minute, I never knew we were supposed to ask that question, the title of the book. Where do the towers go?
So few asked.
Yeah, but think about it. Shouldn't that have been the first question?
It should have been. That's that perception management. So before we really do call it in, please remind the people where they can get this book and dig deeper into your investigation of this.
Well, you can go to wheredidthetowersgo.com. And there you can buy it through my website, or there's a link to take you to Amazon or Barnes & Noble's. You know, you get your choices there. Or do a search on Where Did the Towers Go? There's also that movie that's freely available online in bite-sized pieces, Irrefutable.
Perfect.
And so go to tinyurl.com/irrefutabletv.
Sounds good. And also that presentation you have on the front of your website is also great at walking people through the mountain of evidence in this book.
I start out, and I'll ask you the question. Is the answer 27 the right answer?
You got to know the question to know the answer.
Yes. Congratulations.
Awesome. Well, thanks again. It is an honor and a pleasure. I've taken up a lot of your time, but I have so much respect for what you've done, and keep doing what you do.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I have a lot of respect for you for that courage.
There it is, guys. Wow. I loved it. You know, a lot of people have been asking me for a 9/11 show, and I resisted and resisted, thinking, you know, this has been done to death. Why do I need to do a 9/11 show in 2016? And then this listener, Jeff, bought me Judy's book and sent it out. And big thanks to him for doing it. Clearly, he is passionate about this position. And I'm glad we did the episode, because I don't think this perspective has been done to death at all. And I have so much respect for the work she's done now. And I know anybody who picks that book up would feel the same way. It's so full of pictures and seismic charts and calculations. And that's sort of why I called it a textbook. It's so graphics heavy and photo heavy and, of course, educational. I know I couldn't knuckle down and focus and put something this thorough together. So please, if you can't afford the book and just want to get a more visual accompaniment to this information, Watch Judy's presentation on her site or the videos that she mentioned at tinyurl.com/irrefutableTV. I'll include a link with the show. And maybe contact some of your other favorite podcasts and see if we can't get Judy Wood a little more attention. I actually think it's quite amazing how you can now connect the dots between subjects like UFO disclosure, secret Nazi technology, the suppression of Tesla's work and free energy, and 9/11. Obviously, there's a lot of speculation in those other realms, but in all cases, the answer seems to be that the elite will do everything they can to keep people from understanding or discovering this type of technology. Free energy seems to be the crux of a lot of it. That's what UFO disclosure would lead to. That's what the truth about 9/11 reveals. That's why we know so little about the Nazi Bell and the physics that they were working with. It touches on the electric universe model and the work of Eric Dollard. I mean, this is a major slice of the THC pie at this point. It's a staple of the show because it comes up so often. And who knew that the single biggest event to put me and many of us on this path had the breadcrumbs of such a deep topic right there on the Channel 5 news, and we've been looking at it for years. Well, I certainly see it with new eyes, and I hope the case was made well for you, but the Alka-Seltzer analogy is pretty spot on. Watch the footage again. Watch it super carefully. All the edges and the antenna and the things that you'd think would just fall to the ground as solid objects, watch them. They really do break apart and just kind of evaporate, like they're separating at the atomic level. Dustification. You can't unsee it, and you'll wonder what the hell took you so long. But these are the days that I'm proud to have built a decent-sized show here, because of course, we're not CNN or Fox News, but if we can build this alternative platform to even half the size of the conventional platforms, we take away a lot of their power, and I think that's the stage that we're in right now. So please, out of respect for Dr. Wood's decades of work and expertise, take a look at what she's saying, and thank her if you get the chance. I just feel so bad for people who put everything on the line for the truth and are just met with apathy and ignorance. Even the court cases. It's such a shame she didn't get the support she deserved. And guys, I just hope we did a little bit to change that today. But anyway, like every episode of the Higher Side Chats, the first hour is free and we have a second hour for the members who sign up at thehighersidechatsplus.com. 5 2-hour shows for $5 a month. It keeps us commercial-free, influence-free, and stable enough to keep the bar high. No pun intended. And in the second hour today, we talked about the HARP hypothesis that people float around and how that doesn't help, the history of this directed energy technology and the 100-year-old patent of it, more on the relationship between 9/11 and tornadoes. I really do find that interesting. It's changed the way I think of tornadoes. I mean, go ahead and Google tornado damage and see if you think it's really all caused by wind. You really will find some strange embedded objects that make tornadoes seem a lot more complex than just a wind funnel. But we also talked about the fused paper Bible with metal that the Pope came to see, the jumpers and the people coming out of the windows of the Twin Towers. Were they really jumping or were they ejected? Or maybe they were relating to the field inside. I think that would make a lot more sense because really, with the speed that the buildings fell, in the time before that, why would you jump out? I didn't reflect on that much before, but now I see it as one of the many clues to this strange tech that was used that day. We also talked about some other possible instances of structures being destroyed with this technique. A bridge and a building before 9/11, maybe testing the tech. Wouldn't want to speculate, but we also talked about Hurricane Aaron, something that no one talks about, which was in New York at the time. How this whole thing has affected Judy's career, how this tech could possibly split the earth in half, and a bunch of other great stuff. You know the drill. But how silly I was to think, oh, I know it was a false flag, now I know the big secret. No. They're more willing to let you know this was a government false flag than they are willing to tell you the truth about Tesla, Hutchinson-style directed energy. And maybe a tornado gives us clues to this energy, just like lightning was a clue to electricity. I don't know, but I feel like I did learn a lot this week. Hopefully you feel the same. Again, big thanks to the lady of the hour, Dr. Judy Wood, and that's it for me. I've done what I can. Your move, keepers of the quarantine sciences and hidden physics. Your fucking move.
Well, they tie that yellow ribbon round the oak tree. They've worn out all the prayer in their hearts. All along thought they were rooting for the team as they're sent to the game and torn apart. We twist this tourniquet upon the pipeline. from the very start, and that's where they found me. Doing the right thing.